Welcome to another episode of That's So Cincinnati. And it is So Cincinnati today. I'm here with my co-host, editor of The Inquirer, Burl Love. And our guest is former and always part of our hearts, political cartoonist Jim Borgman.
It's always That's So Cincinnati on That's So Cincinnati. But yes, this is going to be a very Cincinnati That's So Cincinnati. Yes, I'm excited. Our special guest, Jim Borgman, who won the Pulitzer Prize for editorial cartooning in 1991 and then went on to create what is now the most successful syndicated comic strip in America and probably the world, Zits.
I mean, it gets to the heart of, everyone has been a teenager.
Has wrestled with raising one or is in the midst of it like we are.
Yeah, that's correct.
Yes. So that'll be fun catching up with Jim Borgman, probably one of the most famous Enquirer staffers ever.
So famous, he got to throw out the first pitch.
So famous, yes. He threw out the first pitch. The Reds did a tribute to him on the big screen. So we are excited to catch up with Jim Borgman, and we're going to jump right into that. But quickly, Sherry, we should probably talk about a little bit of news on the recreational marijuana front last week.
I mean, I think we have to use the word finally here because voters voted for this in 2023.
That's right.
Or 2022. Yeah. And it seems like forever ago that we were talking. Although in politics, we're moving very quickly these days.
We are.
And we won't get into all of the politics, but it does seem like longer. But I guess it was in 2023. But things weren't immediate, like selling from dispensaries. It's a complicated dance of setting them all up. But we heard last week the first provisional licenses, so where they might be.
Right. So if you haven't been keeping up with this, Ohio already had medical marijuana, and there are dispensaries where if you have your card, if you have demonstrated a need for medical marijuana, which that could be a whole nother discussion what that process is like. Let's just say it's not too difficult
That's
to get
correct.
Your card. So probably
you're stressed,
for all
medical marijuana,
for all intents and purposes, there's been a lot of air quote recreational use because you have your card. But anyway, where the state is starting in terms of rolling out adult use of marijuana is to grant provisional licenses to dispensaries that already are in the medical marijuana business to eventually roll out recreational use. So there are steps they have to take. They have to, they have to get their inventory. They have to staff up. Projections are by the end of summer or early fall, some of these dispensaries.
You're going to learn how. You're probably going to edit about 100 stories between now and then.
We'll be online soon. So, but what kind of raised some eyebrows late last week is what?
You know, there's going to be one just south of Fountain Square. And I think
that's a record scratch moment for me. Fountain Square. Now, technically not right on the fountain, but just a little bit south down Vine Street.
And honestly, I mean, this is actually what voters approved. It's what they wanted. I mean, Fountain Square is programmed within an inch of its life. There's something there every night and has a huge draw of people, of things to do there. And there'll be a dispensary very close to there if that's how you would like to, part of your enjoyment of the evening.
Well, if you're trying to place it, it's going to be next to Bolero Menswear, which shout out to Jim at Bolero. I like to pop in there now and again. I might have.
Oh, Burl's fashion, you guys.
I might have gotten a couple fits from Jim Elkis at Bolero. I will check in with Jim to see if he thinks this is going to be good for his business.
I do think it is a good location. There's one coming up near Green Township. I mean, these aren't like, back alley dispensaries.
No,
these are very,
and
the ones we've seen, even with the medical marijuana, sometimes you can't even tell they're dispensaries. You're like, is that a boutique? They all have like cutesy names. And they kind of just fit right in with the landscape. And so you might not necessarily, they usually don't say, hey, we'll sell you marijuana. That doesn't tend to be, the sign. You have to know where they are and understand what it is.
Well, we will, of course, be reporting more on this. This is a change for Ohioans, or particularly Cincinnati, Hamilton County, you know, tend to be, even though politically you've seen, you know, a shift from red to blue, we're still sort of conservative. We're still sort of, you know.
We are, but there's no getting around it. I mean, if you go downtown, it smells like weed. It just is. It's just part of the landscape.
Yeah,
it just is part of it. And yeah.
And so, okay, well.
We stopped at a red light. You'll be smelling it from the car next to you. It just is. Like, people are listening. I know they know.
They know. They know. All right. Well, is it time to bring on Jim?
Yes.
All right.
Special guest time here on That's So Cincinnati. It's like old times here today. I'm sitting here with Jim Borgman. I want to say the editorial cartoonist at the Inquirer. I think I have to say former, but I really don't want to. And the creator of Zits. Welcome back.
It's so tingly to be back.
When was the last time? Now, when you were on the staff of the Inquirer, we were still at 312 Elm. And you did survive the move from Vine Street to Elm.
Yes, I did.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
About half my career in each place.
Yeah. So we've moved again, one block west. We're 312 Plum. So that confuses people.
I still sometimes, if I'm on the phone, which happens a lot while I'm driving to work, drive into the old Inquirer building. I was like, oh, I shouldn't be in this garage.
So you're walking into a different newsroom, but did it still feel like the Inquirer when you walked in?
I can't say it did. No, I mean, it would take a while for me to just hang out and feel the vibe again of being in a newsroom, because newsrooms have just changed so much, you know. But it's exciting in some way. What is that? It's like the DNA of the newspaper is still here somehow. And it feels like it's still oozing up from the floor.
Oh, that's I appreciate you saying that. When we were moving, I often would say, you know, the physical newsroom is one thing, but it's the people that make a newsroom. There's just a certain type of person that finds their tribe in a newsroom, you know. Mm-hmm. Talk about when you first joined the Enquirer. It's not like every, you know, when kids are growing up and they are asked, what do you want to be when you grow up? It's fireman, you know, policeman, baseball player. Not normally political cartoonist.
No, I didn't know it was a job. You know, I was actually in college before anyone explained to me, oh, these cartoons you see, which I had been eating up all my life. No, there are people behind them, and this is their job. They make money doing this. And I'm talking about the cartoons we saw on TV on Saturday mornings as kids. I'm talking about children's book illustrations and, you know, Peanuts and all the comic strips. And then as I got older, these things called political cartoons that are in this otherwise gray page of the newspaper that talks about things I don't care about. Here's this sort of funny thing inviting me to think about some topic or other. And that's what hooked me and, frankly, got me involved in following the news at all, and then eventually became like a passion, like almost a mission. To say to folks, you know, we can all talk. We can all talk about stuff, and it doesn't have to be William F. Buckley or, you know, intellectuals only trying to figure out what's important in this country. It's all of us. And that was the tone of voice I tried to keep in my cartoons.
So for those who have lived under a rock and don't know the Jim Borgman story, you are a local guy. You became the political cartoonist for the Cincinnati Inquirer. What year?
1976, 1 week out of college, Kenyon College. And I had been drawing there once a week for the school paper at Little Kenyon College in Central Ohio. And, you know, more or less to applause, you know, the student body was thrilled to see someone paying attention to the silly little issues on campus. And so I thought, oh, this is a great gig. You know, you draw something, everybody, you know, carries you out on their shoulders. And so I started at the Enquirer. And suddenly, of course, I'm in front of many people with many different points of view. And I'm putting an opinion in front of them before they've had their coffee in the morning. And they started talking back. And it was a shock.
Did you replace an editorial cartoonist, or were you a trailblazer for the Enquirer?
No, ish. There had been a cartoon, a longtime cartoonist named L.D. Warren, who no one would remember now, but at the time was his own kind of giant in the profession. And then there had been a brief period of time when a guy named Dwayne Powell came in, and he was like everyone from my generation, you know, freewheeling and iconoclastic. And he came in right during Watergate into a very Republican newspaper and was practically thrown out on his ear. So he was here only 6 months. And then there was a little cooling off period, and I started just as a young, malleable, you know, a graduate of a liberal arts college. And I really do think, if I may say so, that there was an assumption that being a local kid, I would understand the city and I would fall in line with the Enquirer's editorial point of view, which was at the time rock-ribbed Republican and solidly conservative. And
at a time when you knew where the Enquirer stood, because we wrote like anonymous editorials regularly, every week, if not every day, there was the Enquirer editorial board was a large staff of writing the opinion of the Enquirer.
That's right. And right. that was stated. I mean, that wasn't like a secret. That's what editorial pages were in newspapers at the time. They were the voice of the publisher is the way they said it. And the editorial writers were simply ghostwriters for that opinion. And so when I said, not sure I can do that, once I started developing my sea legs and knowing where I stood on issues, they had to, my publisher, Bill Keating, and editor, Tom Gebhardt, had to go back in the back room and say, what are we going to do with this? And they came out and said, to their just everlasting credit, your name is on your cartoons. You're going to have to say what you believe, or they're not going to come across as strong. And we're going to credit our readers with understanding that because this is a signed opinion piece, it is not representative of the editorial page of the Enquirer. It's its own separate voice. And that's the way we proceeded for the next 32 years. And I wouldn't have made it had I not had the freedom to speak my mind. So I was always grateful.
Do you remember any instances where you put Bill Keating's patience to the test?
Well, when his brother became his brother, what was his name? Charlie Keating.
Charlie Keating
became the face of the savings and loan scandal in was that the 80s or 90s?
Mm-hmm. Mid-80s.
Mid-80s. You know, there was a kind of a, I don't want to try to speak for others, but it felt like there was a sort of a dome of silence over the editorial page. Like, we really don't want to have to talk about this if possible. And there was no way for me to avoid it. It was top story in the news every day. And so Bill never quashed me. And gosh, I'm not sure I could have been that big had it been my brother.
Well, I think you also, you know, you weren't gratuitous about it. Your cartoons were thought-provoking and pushed the agenda of a conservative newspaper, but not without, you know, thought and, you know, and shock for the sake of shock. You did I think you threaded that needle miraculously. And as someone who has tried since I've been editor here to look at options for, you know, people to do political cartoons, I have not found that same level of, I don't want to say sophistication, but like understanding that, you know, if you, like, for example, Trump's an easy target, but if you go after Trump every day for the same old stuff, it gets boring. It gets predictable. And you were never predictable. And you also, at the time, had a lot of other things besides national politics that needed your take. I'm thinking of, you know, the people like Marge Schott, who was, you know, at her
most
Marge-like moments while you were here. There was just, you know, this city community still does, and especially at the time, had some larger than life, colorful characters that you were able to just.
Oh, true.
I mean, I'm sure there were days where you were like searching for ideas, but I'm sure there were other days where you couldn't draw fast enough with all the stuff going
on. Dead right, bro. Actually, everything you've said, I appreciate you saying all those things. Very insightful. It is true. Well, first of all, it is true that we have had an inordinate number of colorful characters per population. And it was always fun to draw people like Jim Tarbell and Marge Schott and Sam Weiss and just Pete Rose, on and on. So that was always a pleasure. But the truth is, I am blessed/cursed with an internal gyroscope that says, but on the other hand, and that tended to be just an operating principle for me. If the city, because I was in a conservative city at the time, I think things are changed quite a bit since I've been.
Yes, they have.
But at the time, it was natural to push against what felt like the establishment voice, and therefore I think I was read as liberal by many readers. And not unfairly so. That's probably where I land. But it's also true that if things went too, if that voice got too strong, then I kind of wanted to talk about the other side of things. But look at this from another point of view. And it was not a strategy. It was simply the way I think. But I think it had a way of bringing people back to the table. And if I always had this kind of governor inside me that if things just got too hot and too polarizing, you know, you'd do a cartoon about the cicadas or the reds or the weather or the, you know, humidity or, you know, whatever. There are always kind of these topics in the middle that everybody can agree on and nod. And that was an instinct as well to make sure I didn't, get myself off in some corner on a rant and leave people out.
Who are your favorite people to draw from that time?
Who did I mention? Jim Tarbell was always fun and easy and very colorful and also a buddy. I have to tell you, he became a friend. Help me. Marge, of course, was just...
I wish we could go back and do the evolution of your Marge from when you started to draw her to how, by the end of that time, I think you had basically, I don't want to say reduced her, but that's the only word I can think of, to like a cigarette and a cloud of smoke.
A thousand cigarettes.
Yeah.
they were sticking out of everything. Yeah. Well, we all experienced this arc with Marge, which was that she was this kind of good-hearted, you know, patron of the zoo. And, you know, she bought the team and she didn't quite know what baseball was and all that. And then, you know, over time, we saw this other side of Marge, which was not so easy to swallow. And so, you know, I just tried to reflect all that. And of course, my own feelings about it coming out. And the only cartoon that ever really got quashed was when she died. And I just thought, you know, St. Peter at the Pearly Gates must be thinking of the good Marge and the bad Marge files and how they were both very tall and you know, how do you balance this out? And I think God was saying to St. Peter, I'm going to have to talk to the dog. And the publisher at the time felt that was not the right thing to say on that day, and so stopped the cartoon. And I had a little affiliation with a small frame shop gallery on Hyde Park Square at the time, and when I was done with my drawings, I'd send them over there in case anybody wanted to collect them. And Marge's sister bought that cartoon, even though it had not run in the paper. So,
when you look back, do you agree with the decision not to run it?
No. I think it should have run, but that, you know, that's why I'm not a publisher.
That would have had to have been Harry Whipple, right?
No, it was
before Harry?
Margaret Buchanan.
Oh, it was after Harry. Margaret Buchanan. That's the first time we've uttered her name on this podcast.
It's been a minute.
Sorry to be the one.
Yeah, I think Harry Whipple would have let that go. Yeah. Well, we could talk about your political cartoon career here for hours, but we need to talk about how you reinvented yourself as the as someone who draws a daily cartoon strip. I have to imagine that, you know, you mentioned Peanuts earlier, but like people like Charles Schulz were kind of heroes of yours. Was this always in the back of your mind that, boy, it would be great to do, you know, to actually be in the funny pages, be a nationally syndicated cartoonist, or did it sort of pop up?
A lot of cartoonists find their way to a niche, you know, maybe it's greeting cards or something. But I think we all start out thinking this kind of mainline thought that it would be cool to have a comic strip or to draw for Mad Magazine. That was what it was at the time when I was growing up anyway. And those were the goals, you know. And beautiful stuff was being done in the comics pages. And then as I found my way into political cartooning, I watched Bill Watterson develop Calvin and Hobbes and Gary Larson do The Far Side and Burke Breathed do Bloom County. And these were the golden age, you know, of sophisticated, hilarious comic strips. And so it was natural to kind of want to be in that arena. But I was never particularly good at inventing characters that I would return to day after day. In my editorial cartoons, I had these kind of doughy Cincinnati characters who I think kind of represented everybody here.
You were AI before AI, because there are some funny things online about, you know, asking artificial intelligence to, like, render the stereotypical Ohio couple or Wisconsin couple.
Oh.
And they're always doughy, you know, dressed kind of frumpy, you know. If you ask, you know, them to put in someone from, like, you know, let's say California, their stereotypical California sort of looking, whatever.
They're running.
You sort of nailed that, like, Midwestern Cincinnati vibe, character vibe. Like,
it's not hard to find him. He's right in the mirror, you know. And we were there, everybody, you know, these are my people. These are my people. And it was very natural and easy to draw our living rooms, our kitchens. And that kind of became you call it a trope where, these kind of folks who represented the local people here were in their kitchen or in their living room talking about something in the news. And that became very comfortable to me to talk that way because, you know, we're near enough to Washington and New York to pay attention to all that, but our lives are different than that. And we don't walk around talking about House Bill 393 or whatever it might be. You know, this stuff, it has a place in our lives, but it's not the the defining thought for the day. And so I always thought that was the way it really filtered down was, you know, we're all thinking about, you know, gay marriage or you know, whatever the issue was of the moment. But it was not so much by drawing, you know, the politicos in Washington talking about it. It was us at our table talking about it. So that was, anyway, that was the way I liked approaching a lot of issues. But we were talking about comic strips, and yes, I was never particularly good at creating characters that I would then, you know, revisit day after day after day. And I came to meet Jerry Scott, just a wonderful guy, and he said to me, "I'm trying to do a comic strip about teenagers, and they just don't look right." And he showed me his sketchbook, and they were all just like little, kind of like Peanuts characters, big head, little bodies. And I said, "Nah, I got a teenager at home, and that's not what he looks like, you know." He drapes himself over the chair, and he, you know, his shoes are always in the middle of the floor, and, you know, is half asleep half the day, all this stuff.
Earl and I both have teenage boys. True story.
Know all about that?
I mean, my son's 18, and he's in his, I would say, prime Jeremy years right now.
Oh, yeah. Oh, right. Like, you're in the belly of the beast.
I could relate to, I mean, I'm a guy. I was a teenager, you know. Work with kids. I could relate to it at that level, but man, to be the parent of a teenager and watch them right before your eyes become Jeremy from the cartoon Zits, you nailed it. I think that's one of the reasons.
I'm honored.
It's the top syndicated cartoon in the world.
Thank you.
Which is phenomenal.
Do you have a son or a daughter?
I have a son. He's 16. Okay. He was sitting. So we, why you're here, you were here to throw out the first pitch.
Well, we'll get into that.
But he was sitting, and he was very into the game. I was kind of proud of him of that, but he was his sullen, not really responding self. So he was there, but he was a teenager.
I did see him. I have radar for seeing what teenagers look like and stuff. So anyway, yeah, so my son was 15 at the time, and he was bringing around his friends and stuff. Jeremy is not my son, but...
Jeremy is the character in Zits for listeners who, again, have been living under a rock, but...
And he's an amalgamation of many different people we've known and seen and been. But anyway, it was really just by watching him and his friends troop through the house, you know? And then I should tell you that in my personal story is that my wife died when my kids were teenagers, and then I remarried a few years later, and Suzanne had three teenagers, and so when we blended our families, we had five teenagers under our roof at one time, and so it was just, you know.
Research was right under your
nose. Sit back and watch. I was the embedded reporter, and I would just talk to Jerry Scott every day. We became best friends through doing the strip, and I said, you know, this is what he's talking about today. These are the kind of, Jerry would write dialogue. No, it doesn't sound like that. This is the way they would say it, that kind of thing. And we got just tuned in together. And then as my teenagers aged out, his came on. So we had a sweet period where we always had teenagers in our houses. And really, I don't think anybody feels like their lives were betrayed in the newspaper. We tried hard not to do that, but the themes and the words and the clothes and all that stuff were right in front of us. So.
So how are you getting your research done now?
Tougher. You know, now I have some nieces who are still in the high school years. But please feed me anything, anything you're going through, because it always changes and it stays the same.
You know? That is so true. So Sherry alluded to this. You're in town. You had a big birthday, and a family member of yours conspired with us at the Enquirer to have you throw the first pitch at the Reds game this week. It drew a big crowd of not just current and choir staffers, but a group we call the ex-choirs, who showed up in force. So had to be a moment for you, like none other. Can you describe your feelings from Tuesday night?
It's really been overwhelming. I did not see this coming. Chelsea, my daughter, who arranged it and gave it to me on my 70th birthday, said, I mean, she just presented it as the Reds have said, you can do this if you'd like to do it. And I said, of course I'd like to. I've been dreaming of being on a pitcher's mound all my life. But I just kind of pictured it. You know, we've all been to games and they're throwing out the first pitch and all that stuff, and you're still kind of finding your seat and getting your beer and all that. And I didn't see it as a big deal. But they really turned it into a big deal. And my brothers leaned over and he said, this is your life. And I thought, that is what this feels like, like a big-time tribute. They went on and on, showed a lot of my cartoons on the scoreboard.
Yeah, and let me just kind of fill in some of the details of this picture here. You're right. They have about three or four different people throwing the first pitch on any given game. But for you, after they got some of the, you know, the riffraff first pitches out of the way, there was sort of this pause. And then, you know, the lights came up, the big voice came on the loudspeaker, and on both Jumbotrons, it was kind of a this is your life. I mean, your cartoons as an Enquirer cartoonist and Zits, you know, the narrative, the, you know, photos of you winning the Pulitzer Prize here. And then I think what brought every baseball fan, you know, got them choked up a moment was the picture of you and Jim Maloney, your boyhood hero, watching the Reds come up. And then you got to throw that first pitch to your brother. I mean, how cool.
It really field of dreams kind of moment.
Yeah.
It really was.
And your family down on the field. Yes, it was not just a great moment for you, I hope you realize. I think not just the group of Enquirer family, but I looked around and I had some friends randomly that were sitting near our section. People stopped and watched, and if they grew up here, they were reliving those moments that you captured, you know, as they flashed those cartoons across the screen. I don't know if you realized that from your perspective, but it was, you know, the Reds did a great job of pulling that together, but the city celebrated with you. I want to make that clear to you right now.
Yeah, thank you for saying it. It's still sinking in, frankly. It did have a feeling, a much bigger feeling than I expected it to have. I was very choked up. And then my brother and I had gone out on the side yard the night before and tossed the baseball and measured off how far it is and all that stuff. And it was no problem. We were tossing easily, like muscle memory from when we were kids. And then I walked out to the mound. They said, I was advised, maybe don't stand on the mound because you'd be stepping downhill, and that may not be a great thing to try for the first time in front of everybody. So I stood in front of the mound, making it 60 feet less, and my brother crouched behind home plate, and he looked like he was a mile away. And I thought, I don't know if I can throw the ball that far. And I did bounce it 6 inches in front of the plate, and he managed to grab it. But
We've all seen worse, so that was good. That's
we've all seen worse.
Don't make him say that.
In fact, when we were on a Zoom call with Jim and Chelsea setting this up, I was the guy who brought up Mark Mallory. I said, hey, Jim, I don't want to get in your head, but I'm going to send you videos of Mark Mallory's. Do you remember, Sherry?
Yes, I do.
It literally went sideways. I don't even know how.
I mean, people still talk about it.
I don't even. If you tried to do that, you couldn't do it. It was so bad. Anyway, but I didn't send that to you because I was just kidding. You didn't have to send it to me.
Everybody else did.
I mean, the stories are fun. I mean, Todd Fortune, he once threw the first pitch out and he practiced for weeks. He would talk about it because he was so concerned about it, and everyone goes into it their own way.
Yeah.
Well, It was great having you back for that. I have to share my favorite Jim Borgman story personally, though, today.
Please do.
So I don't think I've told you this, Jim, but I'm a frustrated cartoonist. Like, I went all through high school, I was doodling in my notes. I was always drawing caricatures. When I was a camp staff member, the junior staff was really angry at the senior staff. So I created this comic strip, The Unknown Comic, and I was lampooning the senior staff. And I would, at night, post my cartoon up on the bulletin board in the dining hall for them to see the next day. And it took them a while to figure out who it was. That was my glorious moment as a cartoonist.
Subversive. This is very telling. This is a very revealing story.
With that kind of background, when I got hired at the Enquirer, I was really excited. I mean, working at my hometown newspaper, but you were like one of my heroes at the Enquirer, and I couldn't wait to meet you. In fact, I had to do a school project where we collected political cartoons and make a notebook and explain what news event was being, portrayed in the cartoon. So I had this big binder of your cartoons that I did as a high school project. So it was like a big deal for me. I couldn't wait to meet you when I joined the Enquirer. And I worked nights because I was on the night news desk, and I would see you, and I was like thinking, like, how can I like start a conversation? Like, hey, Jim, good cartoon today. No, that's, I wouldn't want to do that. That's lame. But one day you came walking up towards my desk, and I'm looking around. I was like, oh, he's coming to say hi to me. He's coming to say hi to the new guy. Yeah. And now, before I go on, you are the nicest guy in the world, the most charming person. So I don't want this to cast a bad, to ruin your image here. But like, here I was all excited to meet Jim finally. And you looked at me, and my desk was by the door at Elm Street. And you're like, is this your desk? And I'm like, yeah. And he's like, okay, well, I just ordered food. So can you watch for the guy and let me know when he's here? And then you just like, walk back to your studio, shut the door. And I'm like, but. That's okay. I'm sure you were like under deadline and everything like that. But later on, I got to know you a little more, everything. Hilarious. But that was my favorite Jim Borgman story is.
I put on social media that you would talk us through stories because you would want to know more about what was happening before you would draw. You just didn't do it in a bubble. And so, but your perspective was always helpful to reporters. So that was my story.
That's nice to know.
Helpful. Like, well, we could go in your office and we would sit there and talk, and you were really gathering information from us, but you were asking such good questions that it would make us think.
Oh, interesting. Okay. Well, we talked earlier about just the vibe of a newspaper and of a newsroom. And that was, who wouldn't want to be there? It's a room full of smart, curious, sharp people, who
opinionated.
Are opinionated, but,
well-read.
Everybody's on it, and there was always a buzz to being around. I loved election nights, to come down. There was that thrill in the air, that excitement. I mean, other people were under a lot of stress, but I was mostly just picking up, what's this feel like? What's going on?
Big news days are still like that.
Mm-hmm.
Like, newsrooms are a little bit quieter, but things are quieter in general in life and offices with people wearing headphones and everything. But big news stories, they're very buzzy days because everyone has different pieces of them and you have to talk and work together.
Yeah, it all changes, but it's still here, isn't it?
Still here, yeah. I remember on behalf of the corporate concern, Gannett, there was an initiative called Real Life, Real News. And I think they must have tapped you to draw the poster for the initiative. And you had drawn a classic reporter, wearing the fedora with the press card in it, walking around a bunch of dinosaurs. Do you remember this? It's like real life, real news. Don't become a dinosaur. We've been talking about change and transformation in our industry as long as I've been in it.
Yes,
and
you've there's been many big initiatives.
Yeah, I mean, it's one that's the constant in our business is that it's always changing. So, well, but we, what we, has? Go ahead.
No, you.
Oh, I was going to say what hasn't changed is the role we play in helping people understand complex issues. And there's nothing more effective at that, I think, than a well-drawn political cartoon. And you had mastered that, So anyway, there's a reason that you were the Enquirer's first Pulitzer Prize winner. What was that moment like?
Well, thrilling, needless to say. In those days, it was sometimes leaked who were the finalists.
Still is. Is
it still done that? Mm-hmm. Like, and they
because
usually,
they don't want you not gathered around the TV or the monitor or to get the phone call when the news is announced. So, yeah, they still do that.
So, yeah, in those days, there were three finalists, and usually the word got out. And so I was told that I was one of three. And I had been one of the three before that. That morning, so I dressed a little nicer that day and all that. And that morning, Bill Keating, the publisher of the paper, asked me to come up to his office. And that never happened. And I did assume I had done something wrong. And he very formally, and it was just like a little tableau, I stood across from him and Tom Gebhardt on my side, my editor, and the editor of the paper on the other side, George Blake, and said, he reached his hand out and shook my hand, and he says, "Congratulations, you've won the Pulitzer Prize." And it was a moment, as you might guess. But nobody, nothing official yet at that moment. So went back to my office and I thought I had a cartoon to get done. I worked on that. And then, the real moment when it becomes official is when the, Western Union operator would call you. And, there was a telegram sent out, but in advance of the telegram.
That's not how they do it anymore, Sherry.
It's kind of a fun way to do it.
It was very cool. In advance of the telegram physically reaching you, the operator would call and read me the telegram, and her voice was sort of shaking, like she was excited too. It was so cute. And they had a photographer at my studio door at the moment, and I just was sort of pumping my fist, and that became
the photo. Fist pump photo. Yeah. And you were dressed rather nicely.
I had a tie.
tie, a cool vest, I remember.
That's right.
Anyway.
Oh, the paper did it up big then, too. They sent a limo to my son's school, to my home to pick up my wife. And then they went together to my son's school, and he was like 8 at the time or something. And all the kids crowded around the window, he later told me, wondering who could be stepping out of this limo. And then they said, "This, it's for you, Dylan. You're oh my God, such a moment for him.
I'm sure it is.
That's what he'll think of as the Pulitzer Prize.
Yeah.
We went drinking at the Hilton after we won our Pulitzer.
Yeah.
That was a memorable night. Dan and I had to Uber home.
For sure. Well, it should be. Yeah, it should be.
Great.
What a moment.
Well, Jim.
Wait, we cannot let him leave.
Okay.
There are other editors at this paper, Burl. And so I've been asked to ask. Hmm. So 5 or 7 of your favorite cartoons.
Oh.
Like we want because we write so much about you, even still, because, and we still run your cartoons sometimes because they still are relevant. But they were looking for that definitive list of your favorites.
Some of the ones that I think of and that people tend to remember to me. Are the Ryan White, when Ryan White died of AIDS, he was a teenager in Indiana who died of AIDS, and famously, since nobody really knew how AIDS was contracted at the time, all of his schoolmates, everybody was afraid to get near him. Just piercing story. And so when he finally died, I had him arriving at the, heaven, and with St. Peter's arms around him and said, "A place where no one is afraid to hug." And Ryan's mother actually had that cartoon engraved on his gravestone. And it seemed to really matter. At one time, I think there were 500 or more squares of the AIDS quilt, that referenced that cartoon. And it seemed to matter to a lot of people at that time. So that, less seriously was whenever it snows. I did a cartoon of a guy with, he had hoarded away all kinds of beans and water and things. And he's in a storage room full of these things. And he's saying, we're all going to die. And, my God, people, it just resonated. I think we all know that feeling. You run out and get your eggs and milk and hunker
empty
down.
Bread aisles.
Yeah, down. That's still how we are.
The cicadas were always just wonderful. There was one I did of two cicadas sitting on bar stools, and there's a lot of dead cicadas laying around them. And one guy is saying to the other, this is it, Artie. 17 years wasted if we don't get lucky tonight.
And of course, the cicada's name had to be Artie. I mean, there's no other.
That's what cicadas are named. The one people I still see is the tigers sprawled across the stadium with the word next underneath it, next, dot, 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 because the Bengals were winning every game that year. And it was just like, who's okay, you know, bring them on, whoever's next. And that kind of became an unofficial symbol of that year. They went to the Super Bowl. Was that 88 or?
88.
I saw it a lot the last time we went to the Super Bowl.
You still see it like as a retro thing now, definitely. On shows.
Well, I mean, more than retro, it was resurrected for the Super Bowl appearance 2 years ago. So. Okay. Yeah, by us.
Oh, good. Good. More power to you. Gosh, those are the ones that have come to mind. There was a more political one when the Soviet Union was falling apart and Gorbachev was the head. And at the time, people talked about the domino theory, you know, referenced mainly to Vietnam. But this was a whole line of dominoes falling and falling and falling, and the last domino was Gorbachev, because we could see the end of him coming. Let's see. There was one in Bill Clinton's bathroom that I got invited by him to see on a visit to the White House. So there was a number of us cartoonists gathered around in the Oval Office, and I introduced myself. He said, I know you. I have one of your cartoons hanging in my bathroom. And took me into this little bathroom off the side hall that later became famous for other reasons. And there above the First John was a cartoon I had done of him during the campaign. And it sort of showed him as an underdog. And I thought, well, that says a lot about him. He likes to think of himself as an underdog who's seating despite all odds.
Put it in the bathroom.
I'm just a guy from Hope, Arkansas.
And then I happened, I don't want to name drop, but I happened to be with Daniel Patrick Moynihan that night. He was a senator from New York. And I was telling him what had just happened to me. And he said, good God, man, do you know what a senator would give to have the president's undivided attention every time he takes a piss?
That's awesome. All right. And then, so that is a very good list. What did you win the Pulitzer for? I feel like I should
collection
know this.
Of those.
It was a collection.
The Ryan White cartoon you described was in that that portfolio of winning.
And the Gorbachev one that I described too. But at the time you would enter 10, and I think it later swelled to 20. And then they would judge you on that body of work.
That's a lot. 20 is a lot.
Yeah.
For like, it's 300, you know, 65 days. 20 is a lot. You have to be the best 20 times. That's a lot.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. I felt good that there were more than just one, because if it's one, it's kind of a crapshoot. But, 10's enough to judge what kind of year. And I kind of felt like it had been a great year. I was, if I may say that, I felt like I was on my game. And that if I were to win it, I won it during the right year.
All right. Well, Jim, thank you so much. Welcome back home.
Thanks.
It was great hanging out with you at the game, being part of that moment. We know you're a busy guy, so we'll let you get. I'm sure you have so many people to see while you're in town.
Well, I've spent more. You know, we moved to Colorado some years ago, but my kids, who are still here, are starting to have kids of their own and buy houses and things like that. And so we're back here a lot more than we used to be.
I bet.
More and more.
All right. Well, Jim, thank you so much.
Yeah. Thank you for having me.
All right. Well, I'm super proud of my reporting skills. We have the definitive list of his favorite cartoons of all time.
We've got it.
Okay.
I don't think anyone has quite pinned him down that way.
So, no, and it was fun to hear about all of them. I can remember, I mean, because we do reuse some of them. The Ryan White one I didn't know about. You know, maybe a little bit, you know, inside remembering all of that.
And I would say if there was one cartoon in the group that he submitted when he won the Pulitzer Prize, that was probably the one that pushed judges over the edge.
Agree.
It was just so poignant and so perfect and... yeah, I don't know what else you can say about it.
So I'm working, you guys, I'm going to put them all together in a file so you can actually see them. And we'll put that out there with the descriptions he had of them. But we want people to see them as much as I love a structure where you don't see us all the time and you just can hear us so we don't have to look pretty every minute. So you got to see the cartoons.
You
got to
see them, yes.
Burl?
Yeah.
You're sounding a little raspy today.
Raspy, is it smooth? Yeah, I don't have much of a voice left.
Smooth jazz day on the podcast?
No, it's Burl's still dragging ass after the Panayiotis Greek Festival.
Oh.
Yeah.
You know, we did not do that. Did you bring me any food? This is an epic fail.
You know what? I should bring some pastries in. I did sneak some pastries out.
Okay.
But yes, 3 days of fun. I have, you know, been involved in that festival since I was a kid. And
you kind of run parts of it, right?
You know, I did that, been there, done that. You know, I was a general chair back in the day. Me and a friend do the security for the festival, which is my favorite job because I'm in the front for a lot of the day. And
you see everyone coming in.
I see everybody coming in and catch up with people and say hi. And then part of what we do is we go from booth to booth to collect the money. So I get to go around to like every booth and say hi to all the volunteers and, you know, Greek food, dancing, all the things.
Do the Greek elder ladies kind of push more food on you, even though you've already eaten?
You know, not at the festival. You know, that's more if you go to somebody's house. I would say, yes, there's a lot of people trying to do what the Greeks call philoxenia, which is Greek hospitality, making sure that people have a good time, that, you know, they explain what the food is. You know, if the lines are getting long, we try to, split the lines into two to get, you know, more people through, you know, quicker and all of that. One of the things that the festival had this year was the sanctuary was opened again. It was closed last year because there was a major renovation to install the last phase of the mosaic art. So that was done and people were able to take a tour and see probably one of the most, in terms of churches in this country, probably one of the most, the largest mosaic installations of Byzantine style iconography. So that was a nice thing. I actually learned something this year because I was browsing through the little history area. And when people talk about Cincinnati or when the Greeks immigrated here, their contributions seem to center around lunch counters and chili. But there is also a
chili?
Rich chili.
No, we never talk about
right?
that.
There's also a rich history in candy and confectionery. So we all know Aglamisi's, right?
Yes.
But and a lot of the candy, you know, Cincinnati, if you read up on, you know, things like where was the opera cream invented, Cincinnati. So Cincinnati is a rich candy history, mostly driven by German immigrants. But during the Balkan Wars, when the Greeks started coming here, many of them brought their skills as candy makers too. So there was a little exhibit someone put together of all these candy stores that were in Cincinnati in the late 1800s, early 1900s, including a place called Zutis, which had
was one of the places that was center in Cincinnati's struggle during the civil rights era. So just a rich history, not just, it's not just about chili, Sherry. There was,
where this, was it located? Do you remember?
I think it was downtown. I can't remember which street. I knew you were going to ask me a question I couldn't answer. But
feels like that's a history column in the making, though.
Here I was thinking I knew it all on the back of my hand, but somebody. But no, it's always a nice festival. It's interesting here because when I've been in other cities, especially larger cities, there are Greek festivals, but they're not nearly as big as the one in Cincinnati. It truly has sort of become a quasi-city festival.
No, it's the one you hear about. Like, there's all of the Catholic festivals, of course, but then right. you hear about the Greek festival.
And that's why, like, when I was in D.C., there was, you know, there's probably three or four large Greek Orthodox parishes, and they all have festivals, but because there's several of them, not one really has gotten large. And, you know, I remember when we first moved here in the 70s, the festival was just starting to grow, and the church was trying to prepare all this food out of like a typical church kitchen, right? So over the years, you know, the church has invested in this huge commercial kitchen, you know, extended the parking. The church has more parking than it would ever need for, you know, a typical Sunday. But it was expanded just so that they could have, you know, a larger festival grounds and everything like that. So, yeah, other than the monsoon that blew through Saturday afternoon.
Not for too long, though.
And it wasn't for too long, but man, it rained hard and it was blowing sideways. My buddy George Perdikakis, there's a good Greek name for you, was in charge of the shish kebabs, the souvlaki, and he had the grills. He had like 8 grills fully loaded with shish kebabs, and that rain came through and just like blew them all out, blew the fires out and everything. It was pretty dramatic, Sherry.
You had a good Sunday Friday night.
Everybody, you know, got undercover under the tents and waited it out, and then as soon as the rain stopped, the music came back on, and it was good because it washed away the first night's worth of like spilled beer and wine and sticky honey syrup and everything, you know. Like, I have a special pair of shoes just for the festival I can't wear anywhere else because they basically, you know, have...
I have my Riverbend concert shoes. Exactly. They live in the garage. Yeah.
Well, anyway, that was my Cincinnati moment, which lasted the whole weekend.
All right, I like it.
Yeah.
All right, you guys, before we wrap up here... the next episode of That's So Cincinnati is being recorded live on July 3rd at Jungle Gyms in Fairfield. I'm super excited. Burl secured our guest, the owner.
Actually, Lisa did.
Okay.
Lisa had to work hard on this one because Jungle, as he's called, has a very, very busy schedule. In fact...
And we're going to him.
We're going to him, but that's cool because if you've been to Jungle Gyms in Fairfield... when you walk in, you see they have this like really cool studio where they do their own podcasting. It's, you know, big glass windows. So if you walk in and they're recording, you can see what's going on there. So
we're doing it live.
We're going to do it live. I don't want to say it's better than our studio, but it's probably better than our studio. So
our studio has its own charm because we have lovely views and the guests do love to see
that. We do. Yes. So there we go. Well, should we wrap this up?
We should. Thank you for listening to That's So Cincinnati podcast, a production of The Inquirer and Cincinnati.com.
That's So Cincinnati is sponsored once again by Cincinnati.com, the online home of The Inquirer. If you'd like to sponsor an episode listened to by thousands each week, email me personally at blove@cincinnati.com. Well, I don't know, but I've been told you never slow down, you never get old.
That's So Cincinnati was produced today by Phil Didion.
No, it wasn't.
All right, you're gonna have to smooth that out.
No, let's keep rolling. That was funny.
Sam Green.
Yay, Sam.
It's like muscle memory. I've already called him Phil once, and I've known Sam since he was a young intern.
And here he is, pinch hitting for Phil.
Phil is allowed to take vacation. Lisa Gillespie books our guests. If you like what you're hearing, please subscribe on your favorite podcast platform and share us with a friend.
And finally, if you value local journalism, please consider a digital subscription to The Enquirer. Just click on subscribe at the top of Cincinnati.com. And remember, I'm tired of screwing up. I'm tired of going down. I'm tired of myself. I'm tired of this town.